produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world. Featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org, and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. It's Thursday, May 15th, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, and this is your normal daily audio stash. Don't forget to get on the phone and call your Congress at 202-224-3121. Tell your representative to support Ron Paul's H.R. 5842, the bill to end DEA raids in medical marijuana states, and Barney Frank's H.R. 5843, the bill to end federal penalties for personal possession of marijuana. Today on the Daily Audio Stash, we're speaking with Normal founder and legal counsel Keith Strop, who will update us on the outcome of his trial in Massachusetts on charges he smoked a doobie in public at the Boston Freedom Rally. Cannabis Carry brings us some more island beats with some reggae from Mikey Dread. This Jamaican dub hit is called Dizzy Herb Smoker. Though he passed from this earth in March, his music lives on and infuses us all with that Irie vibe. Then we'll finish up with Charles Thomas from the Interfaith Drug Policy Alliance. He's here to tell us about support for medical marijuana in Minnesota from the clergy of many denominations and their efforts to convince the governor to not veto the upcoming medical marijuana bill. We've got a lot to cover, so sit back and relax with Bong Crosby and your favorite strain and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Washington inmate in severe pain without medical marijuana. From KOMO-TV, Seattle, Washington. A 35-year-old Shelton man is fighting for the right to use medical marijuana. The problem is that Alex Morris is in the Snohomish County Jail. The state's Medical Marijuana Act does not cover inmates of jails or prison. Alex is in jail for 30 days. His wife says those 30 days will make him very, very sick. Kim Morris said, quote, "He's in severe pain, unbearable, excruciating pain, because he's not able to eat to keep things down. He's lost 10 pounds in the last 8 days, end quote. Alex has Crohn's disease and as a result suffers severe headaches. The law covers that, and Alex has had his doctor's permission. He's registered as a user of medical marijuana. Alex said, speaking from jail, quote, "It allows me to eat, to hold food down, to come out of my dark hole I'm in." His wife added, quote, "Alex has tried all the other medications for Crohn's, and for him, they don't work," end quote. But jail officials say Washington law clearly states that permission to use medical marijuana does not include correctional facilities. Deanna Dawson, executive director for corrections in the Snohomish County Executive's Office, said, quote, "At this point in time, we do not allow people to have medical marijuana in the jail," end quote. Dawson said it would take an act of the legislature to approve use of a drug not available in the jail pharmacy, specifically marijuana. The present law does not actually authorize prescriptions, it authorizes medicinal use. Alex's attorney, James Kovac, said, quote, "I don't have a problem with people being in custody. The question is it cruel and unusual punishment to keep a person incarcerated and not provide them with the vital medications they require?" End quote. This is a story that has been told before, regrettably ending in the deaths of patients like Peter McWilliams. No operational state medical marijuana law allows the prescription for marijuana because that would run afoul of the federal government's regulations regarding drug scheduling, and any doctor who prescribes marijuana would lose his license to prescribe any drug. So, states have set up recommendations for marijuana, and the Clinton administration even tried to intimidate doctors to not recommend marijuana, but the Supreme Court ruled that would violate doctors' rights to free speech. Until we can end adult marijuana prohibition at the federal level, there will continue to be this conflict between federal and state law, and more patients in jails, like Alex Morris, will have to suffer. Pot industry ranks second in British Columbia's gross domestic product contribution. A British Columbia magazine now places the province's marijuana industry in second place for its contribution to the British Columbia gross domestic product. BC Business Magazine said recently that it is now in second place, ahead of the forest sector and behind construction. Forest Minister Rich Coleman reacted to the announcement by saying, quote, "There's nothing a ministry can do to change a marketplace," end quote. BC Business places the provincial marijuana industry at $7.5 billion with a labor force of over 250,000. Eric Nash of Valley-based cannabis company Island Harvest reacted to the news by saying, quote, "More than 156,000 people in British Columbia use marijuana for health purposes. Thousands of unemployed British Columbia forest workers could become gainfully employed in the well-established cannabis industry," end quote. Island Harvest has been distributing and selling medical marijuana to customers for the past 6 years under federal licensing from Ottawa. Wendy Little, his partner in Island Harvest, added, quote, "Provincially licensed operations in British Columbia have been supplying marijuana to thousands of people for over 10 years now. It's time to integrate cannabis sensibly into our economy," end quote. Legally licensed growers, Little and Nash, have called upon the British Columbia government to implement provincial policy and declare the cannabis production sector a renewable and sustainable health-based industry to create employment and economic growth. The economics of marijuana and hemp are likely to be the deciding factors in overturning adult marijuana prohibition in North America. With farmers needing a cash crop, with drivers needing biodiesel fuels, with people needing affordable medicines, with the world needing sustainable food and ecologically friendly fiber crops, and governments straining to balance budgets, the prohibition of cannabis will soon become a money-losing proposition, even compared to the profits some industries make from prohibition. Republican response to Obama comments on medical marijuana. This is in response to yesterday's story on Senator Barack Obama campaigning in Oregon, stating that he would base medical marijuana policy on, quote, sound science and end the DEA raids in medical marijuana states. From the Republican National Committee, Washington, D.C. RNC Communications Director Danny Diaz released the following statement today, quote, "Barack Obama's pledge to stop executive agencies from implementing laws passed by Congress raises serious doubts about his understanding of what the job of the President of the United States actually is. His refusal to enforce the law reveals that Barack Obama doesn't have experience necessary to do the job of president, or that he fundamentally lacks the judgment to carry out the most basic functions of the executive branch. What other laws would Barack Obama direct federal agents not to enforce?" End quote. Oh, please, is this coming from the party of the current administration that has seen fit to stop executive agencies from enforcing subpoenas by Congress? Or the refusal to enforce the laws prohibiting torture? Is this the very same Republican National Committee that has flagrantly violated the laws concerning archival of executive records by using RNC email accounts for official executive business? And by failing to back up millions of executive emails leading up to the invasion of Iraq? And now this party wants to enforce laws that send stormtroopers with weapons to terrorize sick and disabled Californians, seize cash and crops, and yet never charge anyone with breaking those laws? Judging by public opinion, which overwhelmingly supports medical marijuana, trying to bash Senator Obama for his pledge to end DEA raids seems to me a political loser. While today's Republican Party may officially denounce medical marijuana, classic conservatives have always favored regulation of cannabis, and many feel that a federal government that interferes in a doctor-patient relationship has overstepped its bounds. 15 Republicans voted for Hinchy Rohrabacher in its last offering, and Republican Ron Paul is sponsoring the latest incarnation of that bill to end DEA raids in medical marijuana states. Strop and Cusick convicted of smoking pot, given one day prison time. From the Harvard Crimson. Most marijuana users who get caught smoking a joint summarily pay a fine. But when an undercover police officer detained Richard E. Cusick and R. Keith Strop, the two chose instead to challenge the constitutionality of Massachusetts laws banning marijuana for the first time in 30 years. Arrested for sharing a marijuana cigarette at the annual Boston Freedom Rally in September, Cusick and Strop turned to Harvard Law School professor Charles R. Nesson for legal counsel. Nesson and his clients acknowledged that they had used the illegal drug and decided upon an unusual defense. They argued that the statute outlawing marijuana in Massachusetts has no rational basis, and that the jury has the power of jury nullification, or ruling a defendant innocent while recognizing that he or she had violated a law. Both co-defendants built their careers around marijuana. Cusick is associate publisher of the well-known marijuana magazine High Times, and Strop is the founder of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. They said that they do not believe marijuana to be a social ill. Nesson said he had hoped that several experts, including Lester S. Grinspoon, an associate professor emeritus at Harvard Medical School, and Jeffrey A. Myron, director of undergraduate studies in economics, would be allowed to testify to the harmlessness of marijuana. But the defendants were not granted an evidentiary hearing, and the jury found them guilty of marijuana possession after deliberating briefly. The judge sentenced them to one day in prison, which they had already served the day that they were arrested. Nesson said in an interview yesterday, quote, "The idea that they were found guilty of a crime was just crushing to me," end quote. Although Nesson plans to file an appeal, it is unlikely that an appellate court will rule to change the verdict. Now stay tuned just a little bit. Right after the news, we'll have my interview with Keith Strop on his conviction for marijuana crime.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Hey, Stashers, it's time for another great Pass the Stash contest. This time I've got a great video from Suburban Noise Records artist King Spade. Their new DVD, Throw Your Spades Up, Live at the Key Club, features Richter and D-Loc busting some hardcore flow in a video featuring 19 of their best raps, including Spaded, Faded, and Jaded, Drunk into Club, and Smokin' Doja. All you have to do to win is send me an email at stash@normal.org with just two things. A picture from your local global marijuana march. I'm mostly looking for a huge crowd shot in the streets so we can show the world our massive support for ending adult marijuana prohibition. Or the most interesting, funny, sexy picture of a marijuana activist or a sign from the marijuana march. and one of the most creative chants you use during the marijuana march. For example, hey, hey, ho, ho, prohibition's got to go, or I smoke pot and I like it a lot, but something newer and more creative. That's it, just a picture and a chant. However, don't send me links to pictures stored at PhotoBucket or Flickr. I don't have time to scan through them all and recopy them. Just attach a few pictures as a JPEG and send it to stash@normal.org. I'll announce the winner this Friday, and you'll receive your DVD copy of King Spade in the mail. So thanks for listening, and thanks for playing Pass the Stash.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves, and you're enjoying Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Please take a moment right now to support this organization by donating online.
We're joined now by the founder and the legal counsel for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Keith Straub, who's joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C. Keith has been involved in a case stemming from his arrest with Rick Cusick, the former editor of High Times, for smoking a joint out in public at the grounds of the Boston Freedom Rally last year. We've been updating the case as it's gone through the Massachusetts courts, and we're here to talk to Keith about the latest developments. So, Keith, how are you?
I'm doing fine, bud. What's up?
I wanted to talk to a convicted criminal.
I was disappointed we didn't achieve more than we wanted. On the other hand, the fact that one can smoke a joint at the Boston Common, get arrested, go to trial, and still get no punishment other than the cost and the effort of taking it to trial. But otherwise, we didn't get any jail time, any fine, any fees, anything else. So I can't feel too bad about it.
Yeah, so they didn't allow you to have the evidentiary hearing, I guess.
No, they wouldn't give us... we were hoping he would reopen that, in which case it would have put the trial off for a while. You know, we would have probably had a hearing in a month and bring in witnesses, and it would have given us an opportunity to strengthen our constitutional argument. But frankly, going to have a hard time winning that constitutionally because they apply the rational basis test, and that's a pretty low test, easy to meet. So
now, what exactly does that mean, rational basis?
Well, what it says, if the government has any rational basis for passing the law, even if, cases say, even if we find out later they're not factual, but if they thought they were a rational basis, that's good enough. Now, if it's considered a fundamental right, like the right to free speech and right to privacy, the government has to show an overriding state interest in order to interrupt that fundamental right. But they won't consider marijuana as part of right to privacy. They just consider it an ordinary question of can you or can you not smoke marijuana, and therefore they apply the rational basis test. And it's, as I say, the only time you could ever win on a rational basis is if a court was willing to say there is no possible way they could have thought marijuana was harmful, therefore, you know.
Yeah, and so they, with this rational basis, it's almost like a good faith. If they're in good faith
that's
saying...
that's exactly right. They could be wrong, but if they were... acting in good faith, that's all that's required. You're right. That's a good way to put it.
Okay, now another part of your case involved trying to use the jury nullification. How did that go over?
Well, it was interesting. We went ahead and tried it. We were surprised, but the prosecutors actually came to us with a proposal. Now, they put it in terms of suggesting somehow it was better for all of us, and they wanted us to stipulate to the facts at trial, do away with the jury, try the case on the stipulated facts before the judge. Well, obviously, the stipulated facts, we were prepared to take a stand and say, yes, we were smoking a joint. So based on stipulated facts, you're going to be convicted. But all of a sudden, you're not before a jury, so you don't have any chance for nullification. And so surprisingly, my co-defendant and two of the attorneys were feeling like, well, maybe that's not so bad. I think their reasoning was that we might get a timely review by the appellate courts if we went up on stipulated findings where the government and the defendants were both asking the Court of Appeals to review this. Well, if I thought we had a good chance to win on appeal, I guess that would have more appeal. But again, I think that's a long shot that we're going to win on appeal. So I thought it was far more important that we have the chance to try to convince a jury that, yes, we did it, but if they convict us of the crime, it's going to create an injustice. You can't use the word jury nullification, but you can talk in terms of the jury. At least this judge let Nesson talk in terms of the fact that the first step is, did they did they commit the elements of the crime? But the second step really is whether it would be justice to convict them of this offense. And the government objected, but we went ahead and the judge went ahead and let him argue that. Now, as it turns out, here's what happened. Of the first six witnesses, four of them were on our side, one of whom actually said, "Judge, there's no way I could honestly decide this case. Frankly, if the defendants put a joint in their mouth while they were on the stand, I am not willing to convict them." He was a marijuana smoker, and he was going to make his position. Now, of course, if he would have only realized, keep your mouth shut and stay on the jury. But we had a total of four of those, so the others weren't quite as outrageous. But, you know, basically they asked him, is there any reason why you might have a bias or prejudice that would keep you from rendering a just verdict? And they raised their hand. So one by one, individually, they're brought up in question. And they asked them, you know, what's the problem? Why can't you do it? And they said, well, I just don't think this is an important enough thing. I don't think the courts ought to be, you know, treating marijuana smoking like a crime. Well, at that point, you know, the judge has to excuse them for cause. Well, he asked, there's a follow-up question. Could you set that aside and still render a fair and honest verdict? Well, I'm just not sure. So what happens is the jurors who are on our side but honest get taken off, and so the ones that were left were not in the mood to play with us. So either they didn't realize they could refuse to convict us, or they just didn't give a shit, and it was hard to tell. But they were only out about 30 minutes and came back with a guilty verdict on both of us. Now, the good news is the judge immediately went into sentencing. He didn't do any of this 30 days or 60 days to get a background check, because if he would, we would have been on drug testing and all kinds of bullshit. You know, he goes right to the prosecutors, and prosecutors wanted 6 months probation. They didn't mention drug testing, but you can bet your ass that they would have wanted it. And they also wanted us to be banned from attending the 2008 Boston Freedom Rally, which I think would be totally unconstitutional in any event. The judge just flat out, before he even bothered to hear from our side, he just said, no, I reject that. In fact, I'm going to give the defendants time served, which is one day they served when they were first arrested. Otherwise, case is done.
Now
no fine, no fee, you know. Now, we got a misdemeanor conviction, but on the other hand, it's about as light a penalty as you can ever get if you're convicted. Usually, if you take a case to trial when they're trying to get you not to go to trial, you kind of pay a price. You know, if you're convicted, you usually get hit a little harder than you otherwise would. This judge recognized that we really were raising an intellectual challenge, and he appreciated it. So,
well, that's good news.
No harm, no foul, no harm.
Now, did you actually spend a full day in jail on your day of your arrest?
No, we didn't spend any time in jail. We spent about 30 or 40 minutes in a holding tent, but it was on the Boston Common. We weren't even in handcuffs.
So the time served.
We were in custody. And if you're in custody even for a moment, when they're counting your time that you have to serve, that counts as one day.
Oh.
And so the judge just said, okay, time served, one day, time served.
Gotcha, okay. So you get credit for
the judge only sentenced us to one day, and then he immediately found that we had already served that one day, so we had completed our sentence.
Isn't it a kind of a strange system of this when they're vetting the jury? You were talking about them asking the people their opinions on marijuana laws, that here we are trying to get a intellectual challenge to the constitutionality of a marijuana law, but the way that the system is set up, it weeds out, pardon the pun, the people who would be most amenable to hearing that law.
No, you're absolutely right. And by the way, it's not just on the marijuana. Even on an ordinary criminal case, there are some people who, when they serve on a jury, really are inclined to believe the defense and to hold the government to a fairly high standard. But the problem is, if they say that very openly, they're going to be struck. You know, so I agree with you. I think what happens is, in an effort to try to end up with jurors that aren't pre-biased, what we really end up with jurors who follow the rules and believe whatever the government tells them, but we don't end up with the ones who really are willing to challenge the government. So yeah, it is a little bit of a weird system. I still thought we might get it, but we didn't. So hey, and it wasn't because of the judge. I really honestly have to say, I thought this judge gave us every opportunity to try to make our case. So it was just one of those where we weren't given. The first day when we were there at the assignment court, the judge tried to dismiss it altogether. And at first he said, this is not, how much marijuana was involved? And they said, only a joint. And he said, oh, this is wasting the court's time. I'm going to dismiss these charges. They'll just have to pay the fee, you know, whatever the fee is, a few hundred bucks. And our lawyer stands up and says, Your Honor, they, you know, these are people that believe very strongly in what they're doing. They are entitled to a jury trial, and they very much want to go forward. He said, well, I'll tell you what then. We'll not only dismiss the charges, we'll dismiss the fine and the cost, so it won't cost them anything. And this time, Nesson got up and he said, Your Honor, Keith Stropp is the founder of Normal, and Rick Cusick is a publisher of High Times magazine. They must respectfully insist on their right to trial. And the judge gets a big smile on his face, and he looks up and he says, I get it. You want jury nullification. Courtroom 19. He knew exactly what we were doing, and it was all right once he understood. You know, he didn't want us wasting their time, but once he understood we were willing to roll the dice and take our risk, he said, sure.
Man, I imagine there's got to be a lot of judges out there that really are on our side with regard to these laws and are just sick of having their time wasted, but they can't really speak up.
You could tell both of those judges, the original Simon judge and the trial judge, I guarantee you they were on our side. They were, and again, it wasn't so much that Pot's okay, although I think the second guy, he was a former public defender, and I suspect probably had some experience with Bob himself. But it was really primarily that they're wasting their calendar on these minor pot cases, and they know it's bullshit. They got real crimes to deal with. So it wasn't, you know, I thought the experience was exhilarating, even though I lost. So you can't feel too bad when you think about it.
Well, you walked out of a courtroom after admitting to smoking dope outside, and
that's right.
And you're a free man.
Yep, that's right. No fine, no probation, no nothing. So I figure, hey, that's not such a bad deal.
All right. Well, Keith Stropp, of course, is the founder and the legal counsel for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and we're glad to see you're out in public walking the streets.
I'm delighted to be a free man.
All right. Thanks, Keith.
Just say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life at Amazon.com or visit PotCultureBook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
The definition of the word iree is a total peace with your current state of being. It is the way you feel when you have no worries. Today's musical hit, Dizzy Herb Smoker, from Mikey Dread, sings about the mystical state of mind when one is dizzy. We know what that means. Michael Campbell will always be known as Mikey Dread to his legions of fans around the world. He was one of the most influential performers and innovators in reggae music. His abilities, technical expertise, and unique vocal delivery created a unique sound that lets you know it's Dread at the controls, which was the name of his radio show. Mikey was a technical wizard and held degrees in engineering and electronics. He started his career as an engineer for the Jamaican Broadcasting Corporation in 1976, and that led him to hosting the most popular Jamaican radio program of all time and the first to play only reggae music. He has played alongside reggae greats Bob Marley, Jimmy Cliff, Inner Circle, and Third World. He has shared the stage with Bob Dylan, UB40, and Carlos Santana. He produced music for and toured with The Clash, and he has won more awards than I could list here. Mikey was diagnosed with a brain tumor in October of 2007 and died on March 15th earlier this year. It is not too late to get to know this amazing artist through the legacy of music he has left here for us to enjoy. If you visit his webpage at MikeyDread.com, you will hear his famous voice, thick with Jamaican accent, welcoming you to his page and inviting you to look around. If you haven't already, I would take him up on that invitation. And check out our website at stash.normal.org, where you can get a download of the MP3 of this song. This is Mikey Dread with Dizzy, Herb Smoker.
Hi. Hi, this is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. We are the oldest, largest, and best-known marijuana law reform organization in America, and it's all because of your support. Take some time to join Normal at www.normal.org. Your membership supports this podcast, our websites, our policy research and analysis, and our annual conferences. Changing marijuana laws is a grassroots effort, and it starts with you, the stakeholder. Join Normal today and add your voice to the millions of cannabis consumers who demand equality with our beer-drinking friends.
Medical marijuana is making its way through the state of Minnesota, and it has made it through the state Senate and is awaiting review in the House and signature from the governor, which seems to be the stopping block at this point. Governor Pawlenty has indicated that he would veto the medical marijuana bill. One of the groups supporting the medical marijuana bill might surprise some of our listeners. It's the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative, and we have the executive director of IDPI, Charles Thomas, joining us on the telephone. Thanks, Charles, for being here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you.
Now, according to the press release that I read here, this is the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative. Tell people about the denominations that are involved in this and what their stance is on the medical marijuana issue.
Sure. Well, there are a number of major religious denominations that have taken a position recognizing the medical value of marijuana and supporting allowing patients to have it. These denominations include the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Union for Reform Judaism, the Episcopal Church, the Unitarian Universalist Association, and the United Church of Christ. And what our organization does is works with these denominations both on the national level to get their national offices advocating for policy changes, and we also work with individual clergy from those denominations as well as from other denominations that might not as a whole have a favorable position or really, you know, position one way or the other on medical marijuana, but where the individual clergy happen to support it. And that's what we've been doing in Minnesota.
So this would be part of these ecumenical outreach efforts toward people who are suffering, people who are in pain. Again, most of the world's major religions do have some sort of belief that we need to help those who are the least among us. Would this, you'd say this is how this would fit in with the medical marijuana issue?
Absolutely. What the clergy that we work with believe is that seriously ill people shouldn't be punished for making an earnest attempt at healing. And really it's a matter of just taking the time to reach out to clergy and talk to them about it. We almost never encounter a minister or a priest or a rabbi who supports arresting people for medical marijuana. Sometimes it's just not a priority issue for someone or something like that. But for the most part, once we talk about the issue, most clergy that we speak to agree that it's a valid issue and that it's important and that patients should be allowed to access medical marijuana.
So do you ever find any clergy that have mistaken impressions about the medical marijuana issue, believing perhaps that it might be a stalking horse for legalization or that the people that are accessing medical marijuana might be faking it in some sort of way?
Well, every so often there's someone that's read inflammatory news stories to that effect. And at first they're concerned about that, and sometimes they still remain too skeptical to want to really move forward and take a public stand in favor of it. But for the most part, we can easily address those concerns as anyone could with a secular audience. The distinction with a religious audience, with clergy and members of congregations, is that we can really tap into the value level and say that this is really a matter of allowing people to make an earnest attempt at healing. It's not somehow promoting it for other uses or anything like that. And they can really see the difference between not medical and non-medical. Now, in fact, I should add that a lot of clergy that we work with, as our organization does, believes that the drug war is wrong in lots of ways. My organization is comprised of 500 clergy from dozens of different major denominations that support various aspects of drug policy reform, whether it be repealing mandatory minimum prison sentencing or allowing needle exchange. So there's a variety of issues, and many of those believe, as we do here in the organization's leadership, that it's really wrong to punish someone for using any drug, that people should be punished based on the consequences of their actions. If someone takes a drug and then does something that hurts someone, that should be a crime. But simply using a drug isn't something that they should be arrested for. I mean, there's a lot of clergy who believe that nobody should ever use certain drugs except for medical purposes, but that also agree that nevertheless it's wrong to arrest and punish people for doing so. And then when you look at all the other consequences of the war on drugs and all the ways that communities are hurt by these laws, by the large numbers of arrests and people incarcerated and the racial disparities and the violence in the streets and so forth, that people recognize that even if it's wrong to use drugs, that's a matter for moral persuasion, for people to educate people and convince them and not to treat people like criminals and arrest them for doing so. So there's a wide variety of issues that we work on. We're a national organization in Washington, D.C., and we work federally on the issues that most of the leading drug policy reform organizations, Congress, as well as in the states, we work to help with efforts like the medical marijuana bill in Minnesota. And that's what we've put a lot of effort into in the past few weeks. And we're hoping that this religious support could help make a difference in getting it passed in the House and signed by the governor.
Now, when your clergy stand up and speak out against the war on drugs in general or speak up for medical marijuana in particular, do they face a lot of backlash from their congregations, or are the congregations tending to be more on the side of the general public in supporting medical marijuana?
Well, to some degree, it depends on what the issue is. I don't recall any clergy person telling us that their congregations were upset about their support for medical marijuana. There were a couple of ministers in Nevada who had some grief in their congregations over their support for the ballot initiative that was on the ballot a couple of years ago to regulate marijuana like alcohol. So, you know, in terms of being allowed to have stores sell it and regulate it and tax it. So in those cases, some people didn't really understand that, and they had some concerns. But for the most part, even on that issue, I think people trust in a lot of cases the good judgment and certainly the good intentions of their clergy person, or at least, you know, hopefully have the opportunity to hear them out and consider the arguments and to recognize that you know, it's not like their minister you know, flipped his lid and he's going out you know, encouraging lawlessness or intoxication or anything like that, but you know, to really look at the issues and see that, you know, the major religions are really grounded underneath it all. Most major religions really share the values of compassion and justice and mercy. And when you look at what the war on drugs is doing, it's certainly not preventing people from using drugs, but instead it's really very, very punitive and hurtful and causes a lot more problems. And that's the level that we reach clergy on, is really explaining how the war on drugs is, you know, really detrimental to the values that they hold most dear, based on their faith. In fact, I should also point out to any listeners who are interested that we worked with Mike Gray, a film producer, who recently produced a DVD featuring a lot of our clergy members, you know, members of our organization who are clergy, speaking out against the war on drugs. And it has a 9-minute segment that could be shown to any audience and have a discussion afterward, and then there's about another 10 or 15 minutes of material in case anyone wants to hear more. But it's essentially clergy from several denominations speaking out against the war on drugs, and it's ideal for showing in congregations and really any kind of community forums. So it's actually available through our webpage at idpi.us, you can get on there and order a copy if you're interested in showing it at a community forum, or at least there's links on it where you could watch it just right there on your computer. So if any of your audience is interested in that, again, our organization is the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative. That's IDPI.us. So if you just go to www.idpi.us and click on the appropriate link, you can see some religious leaders speaking out in their own words about why they have problems with the war on drugs and why they're calling for alternative policies.
Well, we'll have a link to the IDPI.us website up at our website at stash.normal.org. So we'll encourage everyone to check that out. And we want to thank you guys for making this effort to convince Governor Paul Entey and the House in the state of Minnesota to go forward with this medical marijuana bill. It's very important for those patients out there that are suffering and could use this protection from law enforcement.
Thanks. Yeah, I went into explaining a little more broadly about what we do, because I assume a lot of your listeners are interested in that. But I should point out that specifically this issue in Minnesota is regarding just medical marijuana, and that even if someone opposes some of the other drug policy reforms that we're advocating, certainly the issue of should patients be arrested for using their medicine is something that should be considered on its own merits, and that hopefully that bill will pass and be signed into law in Minnesota.
Absolutely agreed. Charles Thomas, the Executive Director of the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent.
Leave you today with a cannabis quote from Raymond Kendall from Interpol, the international police agency. Quote, Western governments will lose the war against dealers unless efforts are switched to prevention and therapy. All penalties for drug users should be dropped. Making drug abuse a crime is useless and even dangerous. Every year we seize more and more drugs and arrest more and more dealers, but at the same time, the quantity available in our countries still increases. Yep, it always amazes me that so many people that understand the idea of supply and demand with any other market just can't understand it with marijuana. I'm Radical Russ, thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.